I just got an email from one of the presenters saying they're having trouble, and I guess MS Teams is having some issues today, so we might want to give it just an extra minute or two for people to get in.
Okay. So I am hearing background noise. AGP, could you give me a cue of when to go ahead and start? Oh, great. Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the March 15, 2021 Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meeting, also known as DPIC. I am Susan Tatayan, Chair of the Delta Stewardship Council, and I also serve as Chair of DPIC. And I'm very glad to be able to be with you virtually today. However, I do understand that we are having some technical difficulties with MS Teams this afternoon, and someone has informed me that there is a major MS Teams outage somewhere. So we will push on and hope that folks can stay tuned in for the whole meeting. And for those of you tuning into DPIC for the first time, I'll give just a quick refresher on why this committee exists. The 2009 Delta Reform Act required the Delta Stewardship Council to establish and oversee a committee of agencies responsible for implementing the Delta Plan. And this committee of top leaders from 18 federal, state, and local agencies serves as a forum to strengthen collaboration in achieving the co-equal goals of a thriving Delta ecosystem and a more reliable water supply for California. DPIC agencies seek new ways to implement policies in order to better align our authorities and actions. And these meetings provide a public forum for dialogue about opportunities to align and drive actions affecting the long-term viability of the Delta. And with that, I'll ask Amanda Bull to introduce the DPIC members who are with us today.
Great. Thank you, Susan, and good afternoon, everyone. So I'm going to just list the primary DPIC members that I have seen, and if I know that you are serving as an alternate, I will announce you, and then if I missed you, I will ask you to speak up when I am done introducing you. So today we have Supervisor Don Natoli representing the Delta Protection Commission, Cindy Tejeda representing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Nancy Vogel, representing the Resources Agency, Kaylee Allen with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Eric Reichard, representing the U.S. Geological Society, Ellen Blake, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Tim Ramirez, Central Valley Flood Protection Board, Lenny Grimaldo, representing the Department of Water Resources, Michael George, representing the Water Board, Secretary Karen Roth, representing the California Department of Food and Ag, Laurel Larson, Delta Lead Scientist, Chuck Bonham with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Kathy Marcinovich representing NOAA, and Kristen Peer representing the California Environmental Protection Agency. And did I miss anybody?
Hello, this is Paul Souza with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Thank you, Paul. Anyone else jump on while I was doing introductions? Great. And then just one other thing, we have received some public comment for the meeting, which we will send out to everyone along with some other meeting materials following today's meeting. Thanks, Susan.
Great. Thanks, Amanda. So if committee members, any committee members, if you have any critical 30-second updates you'd like to share at this time, if you could please raise your hand. If the MS Teams raise hand function is in fact working, and Brandon or Amanda, you could let me know who wishes to give an update.
I'm not seeing any hands yet. Nope.
Okay. Well, in that case, we'll do a little bit of housekeeping. If any member of the public is interested in providing public comment, please send an email blue card to the clerk at engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov and be sure to note your name and the agenda item you wish to comment on. Also, please note if you wish to speak or would like the clerk to read your comment and do this as soon as possible so there is time for the clerk to send you the link to join the meeting and be able to speak. When called on, the clerk will unmute you or read your comment if requested. And last housekeeping item, committee members, are there any comments on the summary of the October 26, 2020 DPIC meeting?
I don't see any hands raised.
Great. Thanks, Amanda. Well, that takes us to agenda item 2, nature-based climate adaptation. I am very excited about this item. And rather than spend a lot of time on introductions, I'll ask Andrew Schwartz, our a senior member of and key member of our Delta Adapts team, to introduce the agenda item and the speakers. Andrew will be moderating this item and leading us through the discussion.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, committee members. It's a pleasure to be with you. Brandon, can you bring up the presentation? I know that some folks aren't going to be able to see it, so I'll do my best to describe what you should be seeing on the page. As Chair Tatayan said, I'm Andrew Schwartz. I'm a supervising engineer, and for the last several years, I've been working on the Delta DAPS team for the Delta Stewardship Council, developing that vulnerability assessment, and I've just recently, in fact, today is my first day moving over to a new position as the climate change advisor for the State Water Project at the Department of Water Resources. So I'm kind of straddling the two agencies right now, which is, I think, a nice position to be in terms of this topic, because there is so much overlap between the agencies. So next slide, please. So today we really want to talk about how the Delta DAPS project that is just vulnerability assessment and is now moving into an adaptation strategy can link to or complement climate adaptation planning efforts of other DPIC agencies. And we've got a great panel of folks today to talk to you about these issues. And we'll be hearing from panelists about an intriguing landscape planning tool from the San Francisco Estuary Institute, about some farmer and rancher surveys and potential adaptive land management practices from the California Department of Food and Ag, and some exciting on-the-ground restoration and management activities in the Delta watershed that we think can provide benefits in the Delta. But just before we get to that, I want to walk through a couple of the key findings from the Delta DAPS vulnerability assessment to kind of set this conversation up and to really link to what I think you'll be hearing about from the panel, and to connect that to some of the governor's recent executive order parts of N8220 on land conservation, biodiversity, and nature-based solutions. So next slide. So at your last meeting, you heard from my colleague, Harriet Ross, on the Delta ADAPTS vulnerability assessment and adaptation strategy, which is a two-part process. So we just finished the vulnerability assessment. That's been out for public review for the last 2 months. And this week, that public review process will close, and the council staff will be able to really address those comments and move on in earnest to the adaptation strategy. But staff have already been thinking about the adaptation strategy and where that's going. And so I just want to highlight a couple of things, reiterating some of the things that you heard last time from Harriet and drawing a connection to some of the adaptation strategies we're looking at. Next slide, please. So in this graphic, if you were able to see it, you would see a panel of four outlines of the delta with flood risk laying out from current likelihood of flooding out to likelihood of flooding in 2085, so toward the end of the century, and showing that the delta, this light blue color that is most of the delta right now, is a fairly low exposure to flooding risk. So less than it would take more than a 200-year event to cause flooding in most of the delta right now. But then as we move out to 2085, we see that most of the delta becomes darker blue or a much higher risk of flooding, except the north section of the delta where we see still a lot of light blue. And what I want to highlight here is just how resilient the north delta is to flood risk out into the future, even at pretty high levels of sea level rise and much more extreme inflows. And why that is, we think a lot of that is coming from the YOLO bypass and the value that the YOLO bypass provides to us in terms of flood benefits, ecosystem benefits, economic and societal benefits, as well as just a great working landscape and a nature-based solution. So the executive order defines a nature-based solution as the use of sustainable land management practices to tackle environmental, social, and economic challenges. Now, of course, the folks who set up and planned the YOLO bypass probably didn't think about it as a nature-based solution, but that certainly is what it is. And the fact that it's providing such incredible benefits well out into the future and as well as right now for something that was set up so long ago really gives us an indication of where we think we should be going in terms of adaptation strategies and the types of things that we should be thinking about that really can provide value well beyond what our expectations might be today. Next slide. Another key finding of the vulnerability assessment was on our ecosystems, the fragmentation and lack of ecosystem function throughout the delta. So if you squint real hard at this, if you have a visual on this slide, if you squint real hard, you can see some light blue areas throughout, particularly the Suisun Marsh, the Western Delta, and a little bit up in the southern end of the YOLO Bypass. But all of these areas are fragmented, they're quite disconnected, and they're highly at risk of being drowned out by mid or late century. And so having a transition zone, a place for these ecosystems to go into the as sea levels come up and storms become more severe is really key to planning successful restoration and reintegration of these kinds of ecosystems into the delta. And so something else to think about as we're planning, thinking about adaptation in the delta. And next slide. And then finally, I just want to pull out this additional graphic that we've been talking about a lot with stakeholders recently in terms of adaptation. And this is really drawing the idea out that different areas of the delta are going to need different strategies for climate change. And so what this is showing, if you can see it, is that the north and the extreme north and south ends of the delta are red and are dominated by riverine processes. And so the flooding and high water levels are really dominated by when we have storms. They're caused by storms, and bigger storms are going to create bigger, higher water levels. But if you look at the western and central delta, those areas are really driven by sea level rise changes. The water level is going to change when sea levels change, not so much because of big storms. And so you can think about adaptation strategies that would take place up in the upper watershed or in the river systems that are flowing into the delta. Those could do a lot to help reduce large inflows in those red areas, but are probably not going to do a lot in the green areas. And you're going to need different adaptation strategies in that green area. And of course, the land use and the land elevations are much different in that green area. They're much lower, much more deeply subsided. And so we're going to have to think about land use practices on those lands differently than we do in the higher elevation areas towards the edges of the delta. So those are just a couple of key ideas, next slide, that we've been thinking about and specifically, but in general, the initial adaptation plan or idea that we've been talking to stakeholders about and thinking about really involves three different pieces, which are the first piece is the Delta policy option. So looking at the policies that are in the Delta plan right now, making sure those are resilient and robust in the face of climate change. I think that's something that Delta stewardship staff can really have the expertise and the knowledge and the context to do that themselves and look at that and work those things out. Then there's a whole suite of in-Delta adaptation strategies that will need to be worked out with the stakeholders in the Delta, things that can be done in the Delta in terms of flood risk and ecosystem restoration, agricultural land practices, those kinds of things. Again, the Stewardship Council has a lot of the stakeholder contacts, the expertise and the knowledge and the authority through the Delta Reform Act to really deal with those issues. But then it's this third piece that is a little bit vexing and would be really helpful to talk about in the context of today and with our panelists is these out-of-Delta solutions. We know that the Delta is the bottom of the watershed. It's connected to all of the processes and watershed processes, ecosystem processes, and the water supply system that are largely outside of the Delta but have a huge impact on the Delta. And here, the state is huge. The stakeholders are very broad. The Delta Stewardship Council doesn't have a ton of authority outside of the Delta. And so really thinking about how this can be integrated, this plan can really be integrated and draw on cooperation and collaboration with all of the other DPIC agencies to integrate and to create a Delta Adapts adaptation strategy that is really broad and really engages with stakeholders at all levels and throughout everywhere in the state. And so with that and that broad framework, I think we have a great panel that I'd like to turn it over to now. So I will introduce each panelist individually, and then I will have hopefully quite a bit of time for discussion. So our first panelist is Dr. Leticia Grenier, who directs the Resilient Landscapes Program of the San Francisco Estuary Institute, where she works with partners to conserve California's living resources by developing landscape scale, collaborative, science-based visions and solutions. Welcome, Leticia.
Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody. Ooh, echoey. Thank you so much for having me. I hope you can see the slides. If not, hopefully you'll be able to follow along with what I'm talking about. I'm going to share with you some information about the Delta Landscape Scenario Planning Tool, which is it's based on the idea that we can actually plan out the landscape and get better return on our investment by thinking about how do the pieces of a big system work together. And that's more important than ever right now. We've been building the car of our landscape separately, and or perhaps some people call it random acts of restoration. We've been managing the landscape too disparately, and when a large system is managed like that, it starts to fall apart. And as you all know, we have serious challenges with this in the Delta. Before I get into the details of this tool, I just want to talk a little bit about how, thinking about that question that Andrew just raised, of how do you deal with, in the Delta, being in the middle of this huge system, where what people are doing upstream is influencing you very strongly, and what people are doing downstream is influencing you somewhat. And what I'd say is, what's helpful about the Delta Landscape Scenario Planning Tool and thinking about this is it is based on this idea of using nature-based solutions and natural processes. And by that, I mean things like flooding, the natural movement of sediment, rivers pushing sediment downstream, that kind of thing. Using those natural processes, that is the foundation of the scientific philosophy underneath this tool. And the reason why that matters is that if we want to create resilient and adaptive landscapes that can deal with climate change and still return these functions that are so important to people, like managing flood risk, like creating food for fish, like supporting endangered wildlife, like giving people places to recreate, we need to have the most benefits we can have across the landscape with the least investment. And that means managing the system as a tool and using these nature-based solutions and these natural processes, because the science has shown that those actually return the most benefits. So what's helpful here is that this tool is based on that idea, and with other partners working based on that idea as well in other parts of the system, you're going to kind of have an auto alignment of this system so that the pieces start to work together better. And I think the work of River Partners, people like Julie Rentner, who you're going to hear from, is very much in line with the kinds of ideas that underlie a lot of programming and science that's behind the scenes in this tool. So the idea of this tool started about 20 years ago, really, in trying to think of how can we manage our ecosystems better as systems instead of as these random patches where we do different things with our different jurisdictions and missions. And the Delta Stewardship Council started funding this several years ago, and it's actually been an idea that's now been supported by others. So it's becoming a bit more of a community product for different agencies working in the Delta. Next slide. So why was this needed? There was this recognition that stakeholders from all different sectors need a simple and standardized tool for restoration planning and adaptive management so that you can look at opportunities and impacts and trade-offs and see how your projects are progressing in terms of this multiple benefit framework that I was talking about so that everyone can see that all at the same time. And it's not a mystery that's happening behind the scenes somewhere. It's also based on the best available science. So everything I'm going to show you is really thinking very carefully about what is the function that we want this landscape to provide. And then we've gone into the scientific literature and used best professional judgment and advisors to try to say, how could we measure the potential for that function by looking at spatial data or other data on the landscape? Next slide. And then the idea is that we use that to compare across different scenarios and choose the ones that give back the functions that we value most. So this isn't just about wildlife or supporting endangered species. It's about actually all the functions that we want from the landscape. And so the cool thing about this is that if every stakeholder, every sector has their function of interest quantified in one of these metrics that are then visualized and provided in the outputs from the tool, then it's a way that everybody has a seat at the table. So that as any planner is sitting down to think about, what am I going to do? They're going to be looking at all of these different possibilities that could happen in the different future scenarios. So for example, if I only care about bass fishing and I can get a bass fishing metric into this tool, then planners, when they sit down, they might be thinking about flood risk management or creating food for fish or whatever, but they're still going to see that metric of bass fishing when this tool output is given to them. And so it's a way that we can start to understand what everybody wants out of the Delta and think about it holistically as we're sitting down to plan this big, complicated landscape. So one of the big values of it is regional restoration planning. As I just talked about, you can actually construct the scenarios and then quantitatively analyze the functions you will get back from them at the system scale across many projects. Next slide. It's also useful for implementing the Delta Plan. So it's a way that people who are thinking of projects can sort of pre-align their project to be in compliance with the policies of the Delta Plan. And then from the Stewardship Council side, they can anticipate and measure the impacts of actions on multiple performance measures. So we can start to see what is the trajectory that the landscape is going in. And those performance measures themselves, in many cases, were based on very similar science to what's programmed into this tool. So there's a lot of alignment already there with the Delta Plan. Next slide. And then evaluating proposals, we've heard from some folks who've contributed to this, particularly the Delta Conservancy, that it would be useful to have this kind of tool as they're thinking about where do they want to put the money, which are the projects that should get funded in the Delta. It would be helpful to have this ecosystem scale tool to think about it. Next slide. We've also heard from people developing proposals that it can be useful even just at the scale of an island. So it doesn't have to be used across the entire landscape. It needs to be at a reasonably big scale to think about trade-offs in different scenarios. It's not really an engineering design tool. It's more of a landscape design tool. And then when we're tracking the actual progress of projects, we can say, how are they performing? So there's one thing of what people thought their project would do, but then you can actually measure on the landscape, looking at real spatial data, what actually happened. Next slide. And I've mentioned the science that went behind this. There's about a decade of work that went into understanding Delta function. Some of you have heard about this before. This was funded by CDFW. And what it was really about was looking at the historical Delta to understand how things have changed between then and now. There's a lot of clues in there probably about why the North Delta is more resilient right now than the rest of the Delta. And I think it does have a lot to do with that emulation of natural function that's happening through the Yolo Bypass and those big slugs of sediment that used to come down from the Sacramento. And then we think about, okay, now that we understand how the landscape has changed and how those natural processes have changed, how can we use that information to design a better, more resilient, just and sustainable future delta? And so this work was really helpful to us in building the information that goes into the tool. And the philosophy behind it, again, is sort of large scale. It's based on natural processes that can deliver ecosystem functions. We're thinking very holistically. This is not just about fish and water. It's about pretty much anything that a person, that we can get funded to have built into this tool. So it's a very large scale and long-term approach. Next slide. And what is the tool exactly? The idea of this is that we can take complex data sets that were previously located in a lot of different places. That's what comes in as the spatial data. Then they go through a lot of calculations in a GIS format. So this is actually all done in ArcGIS. There's a lot of spatial calculations of these different data sets to try to understand what is that potential for delivering on functions that people care about. So there's kind of a lot of magic sauce in the middle, but what you get out is a report about how different scenarios might provide different levels of functions of interest. And I'm going to go through those outputs with you now to show you how that works. And you can compare up to three scenarios in addition to a historical scenario and the present scenario. Next slide. So what you're seeing on the right of the slide here is the actual output that comes out of the tool. And this is a historical scenario in green with a modern, this is the present day scenario of the delta in blue. And then EcoRestore is the orange scenario that you'll see here. And there are many modules in this tool. Would you go back one, Brandon, please? These icons in the middle box are all the different modules that are currently programmed into the tool. So there's a summary module that summarizes across everything. Then there's a module that tells you about habitat types, about support for marsh wildlife, support for woody riparian wildlife, wetland buffer in the sense of largely supporting fish, but also other beneficial uses of wetlands, support for native fish, inundation. So these are the metrics that are really going to get toward that kind of resilience in terms of the delta adapts and the goals that you're trying to reach there. Subsidence, impacts to agriculture and infrastructure, who owns the land, what is already protected, and the physical suitability of restoring different sites. So you can see there's already quite a variety of different modules going on there. Next slide. And then within each module, there may be many metrics to try to get at understanding that function. And that is the case here for the marsh habitat module, which is all about thinking about what level of function can you get from the marshes, from the delta, in terms of supporting marsh wildlife. I'm not going to go into the details, but you can see there are six different metrics that are measured here in the table in the middle. Next slide. And they're visualized in different ways in terms of maps, in terms of a table like this. Next slide. And in terms of, you can also look at them in terms of graphs. And you can see by those green boxes that have the percentages in them that all of the marsh metrics are really improved by the EcoRestore package of projects together. So you're looking at that on a landscape scale and quantifying that improvement. Next slide. But I want to show you another example that really gets at the spatial nature of this tool. So one of the reasons it's important to think about the configurations of projects on a landscape is to think about metrics like connectivity between patches for fish. So if you're a salmon smolt trying to leave the delta, you're trying to get really fat and healthy so that you can survive in the ocean and come back and breed again. And that's one of the most important metrics for returning to spawn again, is how big and fat that fish is before it leaves. And one of the ways that fish are able to do that is by hanging out in wetlands. So here's the historical delta. It was all one big marsh, more or less. Next slide. And this is the modern delta, very, very middle, very little marsh left, as Andrew was showing you earlier. Next slide. And here's the delta with EcoRestore. And if you would go back and forth a little bit, Brandon, you can see that EcoRestore adds green, it adds marsh, but it pretty much adds it where there already is marsh. So it actually doesn't move those two pink bars. They don't change very much on that graph because it's not really changing how far a smolt has to go. Basically, smolts still have to run the same gauntlet of areas with almost no habitat, nowhere to rest, nowhere to feed, on their way out to sea. So while EcoRestore is really powerful and valuable, it doesn't actually help that much in terms of this particular spatial metric, which is something that really matters biologically when we're thinking about recovering salmon. Next slide. And then there are these other more physical and social and economic modules that are built in so far, and we're actually funded to build in a few more. This one is about subsidence. Again, thinking about, where's the resilience going to come from and how can we build it? Next slide. Agriculture, how much agriculture is impacted by the EcoRestore suite of projects is what's here, and it's about 2%, a little under 2% of the agriculture in the Delta in total, mostly from...
Patricia, this is Susan. I just wanted to give everyone a heads up that evidently MS Teams is really having trouble today, and we might all get booted off and are obviously lucky that we're still meeting. So apologies to the participants if MS Teams does in fact boot us all off before we end the meeting.
And this is Laurel. I just realized we could view the webcast on CalSpan to see the slides. And I would type it in the chat, but I don't have access to that. So that seems to be working. So if you could at least maintain an audio connection, you could follow the slides on CalSpan.
Great. Thanks, Laurel. Okay. Sorry for the interruption, Leticia.
No, that's okay. Sorry for everyone who can't see the slides. I imagine it's very hard to track without them. So there is a module within the tool that shows how much agriculture is impacted by the scenario that you're looking at, or what kind of crop changes you see. Next slide. And we have several already funded updates that are in progress around understanding carbon better and greenhouse gas exchanges, including trying to get toward carbon market revenue, other economic modules related to agriculture, looking more closely at wetland resilience, which we think is going to feed in very nicely to some of the Delta Adapts analyses and thinking about adaptation pathways. And then one of the big things we're trying to do is actually expand this out to include Sassoon. Next slide. So I'll just end on the thought of what's the big vision for this tool. Like I said at the beginning, the main thing I can see is that this is a way to bring stakeholders together and really visualize and quantify the ecosystem functions that each group is interested in. So it's a way to put that all on the table and in a very standardized way show everybody what each scenario might offer for those functions of interest. And that's a way to get toward a resilient, just, and sustainable Delta, because I think that's what we all want to get to if we can represent the viewpoints of all stakeholders. I do think this helps us get toward managing at the system scale, because we can think about those spatial relationships and how one part of the system affects another. We can perhaps trade off functions over space. If we can't have something here, maybe we can have it over there and get what everybody needs to have happen in the system. And then we can tune the system as a whole for maximum benefits. And I think one of the things we could start to say to ourselves is, okay, if we want to have multiple benefits and we're thinking about those different spatial areas that Andrew was talking about, you know, what's a vision for the Central Delta? That's one of the ones that's really hard to think about. And I think the Public Lands Partnership was a really good beginning that started to show us, you know, there are things that can happen in the Central Delta. We can start thinking about some places that could be restored to managed wetlands that would then be perhaps creating carbon revenue and also food for fish that could be pumped over the levee and put into the channels. And so there's ways, and then meanwhile, those marshes may not be accessible to fish, but they would be accessible to all kinds of other wildlife, especially birds. And so we could start to layer these functions and visualize them and think about what are the important places to do different things and try to get a much more functional ecological system while maintaining as much agriculture as possible and the Delta as a place, and finding that right balance, you know, before we actually commit to doing all of that on the ground, using this tool to project what these different future options are and then agree on what is the most, you know, expedient and desirable approach. And then that's what's the power of the tool. We can all do that kind of in a planning mode without having actually changed the world. And we can do it much more quickly in that way. So thanks so much for your attention. I hope there's still time for questions.
Great. Thanks, Leticia. That was super interesting. And I'm sure there'll be a lot more conversation about that. But Let's go to Dr. Amrit Gunasekara, who is a science advisor to Secretary Ross at the California Department of Food and Ag. He works on agricultural issues as they relate to the environment, including plant nutrient management, climate change, and environmental stewardship. He's going to be talking about some conversations with farmers and ranchers that they've been having and some land and soil management practices. Welcome, Mom.
Thanks, Andrew. Can you all hear me okay? Okay.
Sounds good.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Tatan and members of the committee. I just quickly want to share with you some two items that I think are interesting to this group on this topic that we're doing in CDFA. Obviously, there's a lot more that we can engage on that we're doing in CDFA, but I thought these two would be appropriate for the conversation. Next slide, please. One more click, please, Andrew. So the two things I'd like to talk about and share with you today is the Healthy Soils Program. Hold on 1 second. Okay. Yeah, and one more click. The Healthy Soils Program and then engagement that we recently had with farmers and ranchers on climate change solutions as per an executive order that was released by Governor Newsom in October. Next slide, please. So just a really quick and a couple more clicks. Andrew, please. Great. Perfect. Thank you. So we do have a Healthy Soils Program that can tie into this discussion. The Healthy Soils Program just stems from the Healthy Soils Initiative. When we first started putting together the benefits of healthy soils, which is this middle circle in the chart here, and identifying all the benefits, we thought we were alone in this conversation, but soon discovered there's lots of interest by other agencies, and that's how the Healthy Soils Initiative got created. It's a group of agencies that come together to discuss how healthy soils can benefit their agency and mandates and statutory requirements. From that, we created the Healthy Soils Program, which has two components. There's the incentives program, which pays farmers and ranchers to implement several practices, one or more of several practices. And we also have demonstration projects where folks host one of the healthy soil practices and then have other folks come in, other farmers and ranchers to come and learn about that so that they can then go back, see the benefits, and voluntarily adopt them on their own farm. We also, part of the demonstration projects, collect more greenhouse gas data, quantitative greenhouse gas data, so that we can further inform the models that the incentive program is based on. And I'll focus on the next few slides just on the incentive programs for this discussion. Next slide, please. I got to limit my animation next time. Sorry, Andrew. The Healthy Soils Incentive Program consists of 27 different management practices, so farmers can try one or more of these on their farms. It's a competitive grant program that awards dollars for farmers and ranchers really to try things on the operation that they might have not in the past. We took federal USDA NRCS conservation management practices and we tied them with carbon sequestration and greenhouse gas values, particularly greenhouse gas values, which is what the program's based on. Certainly it contributes to climate change adaptation and also mitigation and also ag sustainability into the future in California. One more click, please, Andrew. We do recognize that it provides multiple ecosystem services, and there's a link, if you click on that, Andrew, one more time, that you can find out more about our ecosystem services work, another topic that might tie well into this discussion. Next slide, please. I won't go over all the 27 practices, but I can certainly provide more information on that. Just to name a few, here's a truck spreading compost to build the organic matter content of soils in an orchard. And then the one on the right-hand side is a cover crop in a vineyard. Both of these help reduce sediment erosion through wind and rain and help with building the carbon content or the organic matter content of soil, which is essentially what is termed as carbon sequestration. We've got a several million to date, almost 50 million to date, funding over 500 projects and 67 demonstration projects. So we do quantify the acres and the greenhouse gases. And then, like I said, we do also request from information so we can further quantify the modeling as we move forward. One of the important tools we use is the Comet Planner tool that really highlights the practice and shows you the greenhouse gas benefits. This was developed by USDA, and we have adapted it for a California quantification methodology approved by our resources board. Next slide, please. I won't spend a lot of time on this slide. There's a lot of information here, but in 2020, with our most recent awards, I will focus on the top four practices. So compost application is that big brown piece with 257. That was one of our most popular practices. The other was mulching, cover crops, and hedgerow planting. So a lot of folks interested in cover crops, which is the 93 piece of the pie, and then the 31 and the 44 are mulching and hedgerow planting. So those are the most common practices. Certainly there's more practices here that can build carbon in any soils that we think can be useful also to the Delta. Next slide, please. Okay, let me switch gears a little bit. The other piece that we have been working on recently is a mandate that came out of the executive order N8220 in October by Governor Newsom. And it asked the department to work with agri stakeholders to identify farmer and rancher-led solutions, climate solutions to inform the next scoping plan process. And next slide, please. So I have a slide on what, when, and where we put together, and this is not to test your eyes, so didn't mean to include the small font, but this is from our webpage. Basically, we had six meetings, two meetings each, on three different topics. The first topic was livestock and dairy. Second was annual crop meeting, and then the third was perennial crop meeting. And we had, the way we was organized is we had one of these meetings on Monday to introduce the topic and then get some initial stakeholder input, and then we had a follow-up meeting on Friday of that week for the same topic to get more information and feedback on that topic that stakeholders wanted to provide us with. And one more click, please, Andrew. We did put out a press release, so we hoped a lot of farmers and ranchers would join this discussion and tell us their thoughts on what climate solutions that they could offer to inform the scoping plan and other documents, including the Safeguarding California report, which has a slightly changed title going forward. Next slide, please. So we just got done with those meetings. And what we did was we asked several questions, some first priority questions, and if we didn't get much discussion, then we asked a second set of priority questions. This was all facilitated by CSUS, the Collaboration and Consensus Program that we have worked with for facilitation in the past. And so I won't read out all the questions, but the first questions was, you know, what additional management practices beyond what we already offer in our incentive programs could be useful to farmers and ranchers in addressing climate solutions? What technologies haven't been covered? what research gaps exist, and, you know, can we get some economic information? Because at the end of the day, we do want to make a business case that these practices might be useful. For example, if you do a no-till practice, you get certain savings from less tractor passes, and that means, you know, fuel savings, but we don't have good quantitative information on that. So it's certainly a co-benefit we were trying to highlight. And then there were some secondary priority questions that we certainly asked to get more discussion going. They're listed here, including barriers to implementing practices and improving existing management practices that we have in our programs. Now, there was also just a broader open discussion to be had on for food processes, renewable energy, and just a broader topic for folks to talk on. Next slide, please. So a quick breakdown on the participation. We had over 300 folks sign up and attend. Actually, 72% of those who signed up attended. We had some other variables we looked at, but one of the most important pieces about this pie chart here is the orange pie of the pie chart, and those were the farmers. And so a lot of folks who tuned in were farmers and ranchers, and we were just very pleased to get their attendance at these meetings. And next slide, please. So I can't share a ton of detail on you. I will tell you that we are working on a report to come that will be shared with everyone. We're trying to put it out for public comment by the end of this month. And I didn't really have the time in my 10-minute allocation today to talk about the details. But here's a sort of schematic of what folks told us. And, you know, even though this focused on climate solutions, we certainly got a lot of feedback that was outside that scope in general on regulations and a whole bunch of other things. And we were very appreciative of that. I think we can still tie those in to a report that would frame the overall message of what people were trying to tell us. Quickly, some talked about overall state policy and the regulations they have to deal with, talked about the importance of incentives or regulations, and then incentives and financial offsets like ag offsets and opportunities for that. Certainly streamlining regulations, how can we improve upon that to make the lives of farmers and ranchers easier? What sort of tools were out there to provide opportunities for growers to understand climate change impacts and adaptation tools. One tool that was out there that was discussed was Comet Farm. It's a similar tool, but with a high degree of quantification and sort of whole farm analysis that was also developed by USDA and Colorado State University together, working together. We certainly got feedback on research, further need for technical assistance. We do fund technical assistance along with our incentive programs, but there was a general notion that there is a learning curve for new practices and how do we get access to that information. Needed more outreach. CDFN could do more outreach on this and then understand the potential cost-benefit studies associated with in the implementation of some of these practices. So certainly all applicable to Delta Farmers as well. Again, we'll share with you all as soon as that report is public, more information, and certainly there's many, many sub-bullets to each of these topics. Next slide, please, Andrew. I think that's the last slide. Okay, great. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Ami. Great. So now we're going to move on to Julie Rentner, who's the president of River Partners, a nonprofit organization that gives new life to river landscapes at scale. She's been working at the confluence of flood management and ecosystem restoration in the Central Valley for 12 years and is prepared to talk today, focused on real-world examples of multi-benefit flood system improvements and their measured public outcomes. So welcome, Julie. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrew, and pleasure to be here. Thank you, Chairwoman Tatayan, and everybody else on the group. There's so many names in here of folks who have worked with us, old friends, supported the work that I'm going to talk about today. I feel like I'm really giving y'all a progress update on how we've been doing rather than a report out on the work that we're up to. So real quickly, I just wanted to frame out that River Partners works all over California now. I'm presenting to you some work from the San Joaquin Valley, but we're in 17 different watersheds across the state and working on projects that deliver the way we're thinking about it is biodiversity outcomes, climate resilience outcomes, improving access to river parkways across the state, and then cultivating the next generation of restoration leaders, which is critically important. So what I have to talk to you about today is a quick update about Paradise Cut, and then a deeper dive into the Dos Rios project. Next slide. So as a lot of folks know about our organization, we really focus on endangered species recovery. That's been the heart and the core of River Partners for 22 years. However, what we've learned along the way is that to really deliver meaningful outcomes along the rivers in the Central Valley, inclusion is the name of the game. So our restoration projects are designed in a way that we can hire locally, put people to work actually doing the heavy lifting of giving life back to rivers, whether that's planting trees or driving tractors or growing out plants or providing the supplies needed to do the project. So as we track outcomes related to salmon or monarch butterflies or riparian brush rabbits, we also track outcomes related to jobs and vendors and community engagement. Next slide. Paradise Cut is a project that's really being spearheaded by a large group of people, as you all know, thanks to a strategic grant provided by the Delta Conservancy and in partnership with American Rivers, you know, partner NGO that we work closely with, as well as the San Joaquin Area Flood Control Agency and others. Paradise Cut Planning Phase 2 is well on its way, seeking to accomplish the three goals listed here. And I won't read them to you, but I will report that, you know, as we think about the Yolo Bypass as a nature-based, you know, climate resilient solution, it's important to just think about how the world is different today than it was when Yolo was designed and constructed. And so what's happening in the Yolo Bypass is we're actually working hard through the Big Notch Project and the Eco Restore projects, et cetera, to improve ecosystem values inside that flood bypass. And in the South Delta, you know, attempting to create a flood bypass in today's world, which is different, requires that we address the ecosystem outcomes on the front end. And so lots of stakeholder engagement and easement negotiations and land negotiations need to happen before this can be realized. But we're really excited to still be making progress on it, and we can catch up about it anytime you feel like giving us a call. Next slide. As Andrew briefly described, River Partners' work in the San Joaquin Valley and just upstream of the Delta, our kind of multi-benefit philosophy was really born out of close partnership with the Central Valley Flood Protection Board and DWR's Flood Safe Initiative, which did an amazing job actually articulating a diversity of societal values that can be accomplished when you think about flood system improvements through a multi-benefit lens. Because of the Dos Rios project that I'm going to talk about in just a moment, River Partners is able to engage with Stanislaus County and Reclamation District 2092 to engage in regional flood planning, so to write one of the six regional flood management plans that feeds into the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan, which is updated every 5 years. And so through the multi-benefit lens that we've been developing over the years and the regional flood management plan, we've been able to describe large ecosystem outcomes that can be developed in the middle part of the San Joaquin River in tandem with flood system improvements. And we're working right now on our latest iteration of updates to the regional flood management plan in the middle San Joaquin, which is immediately upstream of the delta. Our region actually starts right at the edge of the legal delta. We're working on doing a stakeholder outreach around an RCIS, a Regional Conservation Investment Strategy, that would actually allow us to link some of the flood system improvements in the South Delta that need to happen with ecosystem improvements throughout the watershed. Next slide. So this is the project that I was going to dive into a little bit with you all in the couple of minutes I have left. Dos Rios project is in purple with its sister property, the Hidden Valley Dairy, in red right next to it on this map. As you can see, we're about 10 miles west of Modesto and just about eight river miles upstream of the edge of the legal delta. So really still very close to the delta. The pie charts, you can advance a little bit. This slide has some animations. Yeah, so the pie charts on the right actually show just at the point where the Dos Rios project acquisition and restoration funding reached $46 million, how the investment was distributed, both from sources, state, private, local, and federal, as well as program interest. So this project attracted a lot of environmental money dedicated to wildlife recovery and other ecosystem improvement desires of state and federal partners, but also a significant amount of flood-focused investment and a little bit of recreation and water quality. That turns out to be really important because the folks investing in the project on the landscape continue to be engaged both in the development of the project, the deployment of the project, and the follow-up afterwards. And so having skin in the game in the delivery of a project helps us continue to engage with the many sectors that make up the multi-benefit world or the integrated water management world. So I won't go through all the bullets here except to pull out the highlights. This is the timeline of how this project unfolded, and the highlights are that it took about 11 years to get to the full acquisition of these properties. That's with completely willing landowners, very supportive public agencies. It just takes a lot of time to walk through the processes of securing funds and land transactions. So it's important that we're all kind of either empathetic to how long this process takes or really laser focused on trying to make it go faster, which is definitely my preference. thanks to local leadership on restoration planning, we were able to embark on restoring the properties immediately after they were purchased. There was zero lag time between the close of escrow and the breaking ground of the restoration project. So that was really fantastic use of local resources to get through CEQA and through permitting rather quickly. And then the last big highlight is the federal partnership. So we are really hoping to transfer most of this property to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the future, and we are engaging in deeper discussions with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers around modifying the federal flood control levy that's there. Next slide. So I have now four slides that are kind of my like metrics or outcomes from the Dos Rios project that I want to share with you. There's plenty more than just what I'm presenting here, specifically around the things closer to my heart, like the wildlife recovery and the other habitat outcomes. But in terms of nature-based solutions, I think these are the real highlights for you all. So the first one is around flood attenuation. The map that you see on the right here is kind of the way that the flood engineers look at the landscape here. The pink and brown that you can see along the San Joaquin River as it moves from the bottom right to the upper left of that map, that's the designated floodway. That's where floodwaters are allowed to go. And then the kind of hollowed out polygons Those are the primary floodplain of the San Joaquin River where floodwater is not allowed to go. It's blocked by the federal and state levee systems. Well, all of the polygons that you can see on that map have been acquired by conservation interests, either the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or River Partners, and are now able to be flooded, able to take on extra water when the water gets high. What the graph I'm showing you on the left is the hydrograph in 2017. And the sorry about the resolution. It doesn't look great on my screen, but you get the gist here, which is that as the San Joaquin River was reaching flood stage, the green line here represents the forecasted flood stage, going from monitor to flood at the dotted red and dotted purple lines here. On February 15th, the left side polygons on this map inundated through a levee breach, and they took a bunch of flood water on, and in a habitat that's been a restored habitat that's been designed to be compatible with flooding. What that did kind of for the South Delta is it delayed the arrival of that peak water for about 24 hours, 20 or 36 hours. While the magnitude of the dip in the hydrograph that you're looking at is fairly small, the amount of time that it lasted is significant. Like 24 hours in a flood flight is, it can mean really significant public safety improvements. It can mean getting your entire herd of dairy cows out of harm's way, fixing a boil on the levee. It's a big deal. This effect that we saw in 2017 was, you can see it on the hydrographs as far south as Mossdale. Next slide. On the other end of the spectrum, in terms of nature-based solutions, when we think about drought and water supply, at the Dos Rios Project, we've been working with the consumptive use models that are used by most of the farmers in the San Joaquin Valley to kind of track irrigation use. What I'm showing you here is the consumptive use outputs of the metric model. The metric model was developed by Cal Poly San Luis Obispo Irrigation Training and Research Center, ITRC. And what the metric model shows you, or it can interpolate satellite imagery to show you consumptive use of water on a monthly, daily timestamp. So we use the metric model to look at the Dos Rios Ranch project as well as adjacent floodplain restoration projects at the San Joaquin River National Wildlife Refuge to articulate how much water we'd be saving when we restore the floodplain to natural habitats. It was kind of unclear until we embarked on this modeling effort if the riparian reforestation and ecosystem restoration we were doing was actually going to use more water, less water, the same amount of water as the irrigated alfalfa and corn and winter wheat that was out on the properties. And it turns out we're saving water. So you want to advance one? We're saving just shy of 2 feet, you know, 2 acre feet per acre, or 2 feet of water annually. And so what we've what we're working on with Dos Rios is the dedication of that saved water to in-stream flows through a 1707 petition that's at the Water Board right now. This map just shows that our diversions, or the yellow dots, if you can see those way down in the lower right-hand corner of this map, and our petition actually requests the Water Board consider dedicating our unused water to stream flow all the way out to the Golden Gate, which would be past all of these riparian diversions in the South Delta. So it's been a thorny petition, I think, to review everywhere, and I'm very curious about how it will resolve. Next slide. Okay, and so carbon sequestration. To us, it is, you know, abundantly clear that when you grow a forest on the floodplain, you're sequestering oodles of carbon. Our partner, Dr. Virginia Matzik at Santa Clara University, has created the Carbon and Riparian Ecosystems Estimator for California. Next, you can click it again, Brandon. Which, looking at reforestation of riparian areas across California over the last 20 years, this is real data. Yield estimates about 40 tons of carbon sequestered in 20 years. And so, advance one more time. We have yet to utilize any GGRF funding for reforestation work along river corridors in California. And we're very interested in learning more about how we could share the CREEK model, which was developed under a grant from the Department of Conservation, or other planning tools to understand how we can leverage GGRF investment in this kind of work. Next slide. Here's my favorite one. It's the jobs creation. So in the time that River Partners has been working in reforestation and restoration of floodplain and riparian habitats in the Central Valley, we've restored 16,000 acres. We've secured about $170 million from competitive public funding programs to deploy on the ground in communities in restoration practice, hiring all sorts of crews and groups to get together to do the heavy lifting of ecosystem restoration. Some of our closest workforce development partners have been at the California Conservation Corps and several regional conservation corps across the state who have just a wonderful confluence of excellent people who are looking to develop work skills and learn more about what they can do in natural resources, who can deploy readily on restoration projects to get a ton of work done. So we've had a very productive partnership with Bruce Sato at CCCs and others where we can tap into kind of public funding to do great river and ecosystem restoration projects while providing lots of jobs, which have the kind of collateral benefit of increasing kind of local communities' awareness about the ecosystem activities that are happening on these, especially in rural parts of the Central Valley, as well as, you know, cultivating career paths. So I'm delighted to report that we have three people on staff, permanent people on staff right now, who started with us on CCC crews, who now work for River Partners, wonderful people. Next slide. So these are Julie's recommendations. We all know we need to do a lot of work and fast to recover ecosystems in the San Joaquin watershed and particularly in the Delta. But I'm always reminded of that adage of the Ubuntu philosophy that says, you know, if you want to go fast, you can go alone. And if you want to go far, you need to go together. And in this case, you know, facing down all of the climate challenges that we have, I feel like we need to go fast and together. So I think what we've shown at the Dos Rios Project and others like it is that the multi-benefit approach, as you guys all know, can get us to outcomes a lot faster because it's inclusive. And there are lots of other kind of partnership considerations and administration improvements that we can make to go a little bit faster, but a keen focus on inclusion and taking action together is really what I hope to see for the next decade. So that's all I prepared.
Thanks, Julie. I'm getting a little bit of an echo. I don't know if you can mute yourself. So that's a great panel. A lot of information there. I just want to do a time check with Amanda and Chair Tatayan. I think we went a little bit longer than was anticipated. So do we have time for a little bit of discussion?
Yes, you know, thank you for checking, Andrew. Our agenda item 3 is going to be modified. Dr. Rudnick was booted out of MS Teams. So we do have time for discussion, and I'd appreciate you leading that discussion. Thank you, Andrew.
Great, thanks. So Brandon, maybe you can put up my slide number 2, which has the kind of overall question on it. And maybe I think we've talked a lot, and maybe I'd like to open it up to the DPIC members to add their thoughts or comments on what they've heard. There are any. Actually, the second slide with the how Delta DAPS links to can link to or complement climate adaptation planning effort. Yeah. So that's, I think that's really the question like we'd like to get at. We've heard a lot about agricultural practices that could be deployed on the landscape and on the ground effort in the watershed that, and also that could potentially other things that could be done at Paradise Cut that kind of dovetails with the both in the Delta and out of Delta solutions. And then we, of course, heard about the landscape planning tool that really could help us game out some different land management and restoration scenarios throughout the Delta. So I don't know if there are other comments or additions that DPIC agencies and members might want to add to that conversation or comment on, or how they think the Delta Stewardship Council staff should really go about tackling these issues.
This is Nancy Vogel at the Natural Resources Agency, and I got to thank you for a wonderful presentation, and you teed it up perfectly, Andrew. I think what you had to say about the Delta is at the bottom of the watershed. 40% of the state's landmass, or more than 40% of the state's landmass, drains to the Delta. So I think the state's adaptation strategies and natural and working lands strategies are going to have to take that into account. And I'm so happy with the work that the Delta Stewardship Council has done on the vulnerability study, and the fact that you're moving right in quickly to the adaptation study, because I think that will inform so many other state efforts, like the work my colleagues are doing at the Natural Resources Agency on the natural and working lands and the climate smart, land strategy, 30 by 30 effort, et cetera. It will all come together, and it's good that the Delta, given the funnel effect that the Delta must contend with, is leading the way.
Susan, this is Karen Ross.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. So I too wanted to thank the panel for this really broad perspective and echo what Nancy has said, and really stress the importance of, and I think it was our first speaker on the land tool that talked about looking at things holistically, how important that's going to be to bring all these pieces together. And I do think the Natural Working Lands Climate Smart Strategy is a great place to look at all of this at landscape level, and to use this and think through with our federal partners, especially with the new emphasis on infrastructure. One of the great programs we have at the federal level is the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, which is just ready-made for even more projects in the Delta than we've already seen funded there. And these projects come about, they can be great tools for trust building when you're involving so many private landowners with nonprofits and with government entities. We have to remember that kind of engagement and building trust one project at a time to get to the kind of landscape change that we want to see. But I'm very optimistic just given the kinds of presentations that we've had today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Campbell. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi. Campbell Ingram, Delta Conservancy. Sorry, I just was able to get in on Teams, so I'm glad that I was able to get in at this point. I just want to share exciting news that there has been a real uptick in farmers considering converting to rice in the Delta for a variety of reasons. And obviously, in the most deeply subsided part of the Delta, converting to rice is very beneficial because it stops the oxidation of the peat soils and stops subsidence. Also, there's an uptick in just people looking at doing managed wetlands in the Delta as well. So very encouraging news, and it fits into everything we've talked about so far. I guess one thing I just want to try to encourage us always to continue to think about the Delta as two fairly distinctive zones. One is the deeply subsided, most highly organic soils, and then the area beyond that zone as you transition into higher elevations. So all the healthy soils program practices are wonderful, particularly as you get into those higher elevation soils with more organic matter. But when you start to get in that deeply, deeply subsided area of the Delta, one of the few things we can do to at least stop subsidence is to re-inundate that land, get it wet again, and stop that oxidation. Just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Yeah, and Campbell, you maybe weren't able to see. I showed a slide at the beginning of the presentation that kind of divides the Delta into that kind of upland area and the more deeply subsided central Delta. One more slide, Brandon. And I think this is the water level response throughout the Delta, but it's actually a pretty good indication of the land elevation and organics content of the soil as well, and how we're going to have to really think about different adaptation strategies for different regions of the Delta to account for both the hydraulics and as you point out, the soil characteristics and the possibilities in terms of farming and different practices.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Andrew.
Hi, this is Kathy Marcinkiewicz from NOAA Fisheries. I, too, want to thank the presenters. This was really interesting to see and kind of want to dig deeper into all these various plots and things. And as I watched it, I'd like to echo some other comments, you know, this holistic kind of zooming out view, and then also thought about zooming out even further and thinking, can information like this really help us in strategizing climate resiliency actions in other parts of the Central Valley? Kind of further, you know, thinking further upper watershed, and are there actions in the way upper watersheds that could have more impacts on Delta climate challenges than others? Are there actions within the Delta that could be successful only if there are certain upper watershed actions taken? Also thinking about this is, in NOAA Fisheries, one of our, you know, big priorities is reintroduction, especially, you know, thinking about how our species are facing climate challenges on the valley floor. You know, and we look at upper watershed streams to look at the various climate vulnerability spectrum of those streams, but is there a way to maybe tie that into what's going on in the Delta? So we do have, make sure kind of like an action that we take is really getting the greatest magnitude of impact that it can have, and there's not a bottleneck somewhere else because of an action that we could have taken somewhere else. So thanks for this. I look forward to engaging more on it.
Hi, this is Kaylee Allen with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and just wanted to say thank you also to the presenters. These were great presentations. Unfortunately, Paul Souza, our regional director, got kicked off partway through, but he did hear the part about the landscape tool and just wanted to pass along his excitement about the potential of using something like that to help better define restoration actions moving forward, and also to think about, you know, what tools we might be able to bring to the table in terms of implementation, including the Land and Water Conservation Fund. So I thought that was great. And also, Julie, I just wanted to say thank you for your presentation on the work that River Partners is doing. I thought that was really, really interesting, and I'm looking forward to learning more. So thank you.
Hey, Andrew, this is Tim from the Flood Board. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Hey, Tim.
Great. Thank you. I guess you guys can't see hands. I was trying to jump in all these exciting comments and folks that wanted to talk about the work that's been done. I'm going to echo all those and thank the presenters. I just want to make two quick points. Paradise Cut has been in the Central Valley plan. It will be now in the 2022 plan, 10 years and running. So the first time was in 2012. And if anything, I think this demonstrates how important the communication is and the heavy lift that this work is going to be in the 21st century, right? We know why YOLO was done. There was a lot of folks had the foresight and the reasons and the momentum to make that happen. And like somebody said, now we're working in those sideboards, but we need sideboards on the San Joaquin side and at Paradise Cut. And it's just a really important thing to get done. And all the presenters provided a glimpse into the communication tools and ways to highlight that. So I wanted to thank you all at the council for elevating this and bringing this forward. I think it's really important, and it's going to need everybody's support to continue to work together. And then also to look a little bit further upstream at River Partners and the Tuolumne. I think it's an example of what we can do more of. And the timeline is also telling, right? We're putting the burden on smaller groups, nonprofits like River Partners, to pull these things together. Multiple fund sources, decades of work, decades of history. And that's not going to work, I don't think, in terms of the pace going forward. So hopefully we're able to learn from these examples and to try to find a way to set the programs up to better support projects like this so that the state can facilitate them happening more quickly and getting more of them done, rather than having to push that down on people to pull that together on their own. So these are all great examples, I think, of the ecology, but also there's some administrative lessons here as well about how we can run some of our programs moving forward. But thank you all for giving us this opportunity to hear more about it. Really appreciate it.
Andrew, I think we're under real tight time constraints. So if you have any wrap up, and then I'll offer an observation or two, and then we'll move on.
Yeah. Thank you. No, I think this was great. I think I'm struck by the amount of effort and the tools that are available. I think we're at a good place where there's a lot of the pieces are there and ready to be put in place, but there's a tremendous amount of collaboration and stakeholder development to get everybody kind of thinking about going into the same direction and how we can make the trade-offs work for folks and incentivize folks to do the things that need to be done and not just stop the bad things from happening as we move forward. So I'm optimistic. It's a huge job, but I think the stewardship council staff is well positioned to start working these things out and to bring an adaptation strategy forward that can help us get going toward where we need to go.
Yes, I agree. And thank you to the panel members and Andrew. This was an excellent panel. Unfortunately, we are running out of time due to our technical difficulties in the beginning and our continuing technical difficulties. One observation I'll offer, listening to the DPIC members and your enthusiasm for what we learned here from this panel today, is that the Delta Landscape Scenario Planning Tool is such a phenomenal, extraordinary tool. And as some of the DPIC members pointed out, it can be used in the upper watershed. We now have on the ground information, very useful information from projects like River Partners Project, and thank you, Julie, for an excellent presentation. And with the work that the Department of Food and Agriculture is doing with the healthy soils, with carbon sequestration and Campbell's efforts to incentivize carbon sequestration in the Delta, with things projects similar to River Partners Project, and with this landscape scenario planning tool, that we are really at an exciting juncture because with this landscape scenario planning tool, we can actually begin to input into that tool various scenarios from the information we gain. And so I look forward to using this tool, not just in the Delta, as a vehicle for learning more about upper watershed effects on the Delta as we move forward in our adaptation planning. So thank you to the panel. Thank you, committee members, for your observations and comments. We do have some public comments, which I'm going to adjust our agenda because it is important that we get to the item with Dr. Brandt and Dr. Lund. So Dr. Larson and Dr. Rudnick, if you're amenable, I'd like to delay your item to the July DPIC meeting, if that's all right with you.
Yes, Susan, it's all right.
Great, thank you. And with that, we'll move on to public comments. Brandon?
Yes, so we have two, and the first one, and I think he's on, is Dante Nomolini.
Okay. Good afternoon, Dante.
Yeah, how are you all? And I can see some good work going on here. There are a couple of points I'd like to make. I listened in part to your prior meetings reports, and just so you understand For those that don't know me, I'm the attorney and manager for the Central Delta Water Agency. I think it's helpful to explain where we're coming from in this overall picture. Our commitment and desire is to preserve the Delta. We think the legislature recognized this as being a critical element, and important to that is to preserve the physical configuration of the Delta. That doesn't mean that just every 10-acre channel island or what have you has to remain, but overall, we need adequate levees to protect the landmass, and we need adequate water quality to sustain agriculture, which is really our basic monetary supply for maintaining Delta levees and improving them as we go on. Now, first of all, the water situation in the state of California has a great deal of bearing on the politics of the Delta, and I think all of you probably understand that. Droughts are not new, and I provided some handouts. I don't know if we can bring them up, but the drought situation was a key element in the design of the state water project and, of course, the federal Central Valley project. And that is the dilemma of how do we operate water projects to serve contractors through a six-year drought. The basic drought that was used for analysis was the 28 through 34. This is just an exhibit that DWR had prepared that shows historic droughts. I don't want to dwell on it. Let's go to the next one. The next slide will show the planning hydrology for the projects. And it shows that we are woefully short of water in the Sacramento-San Joaquin watershed. It's about an 8 million acre foot shortage. And the federal project, which came before the state water project, had regulated their contracting so that there were different classes of water contract priorities. And nobody intended that this federal project address the entire water shortage in the Central Valley. And if you remember, there used to be a 160-acre limitation. It was intended to be a social project to help people retire coming back from the war to settle on these lands. It has transitioned now into a situation where those kind of limitations do not apply. So we now know, it should be clear to everybody, that the water projects don't have the ability to meet water quality standards beyond the first or second year of a drought. And somebody has to embrace this reality, and maybe the Independent Science Board ought to be the one, to actually show what the firm capability of the projects is to supply water. The state water project was going to develop 5 million acre feet a year for North Coast development by the year 2000. That wasn't done, and therefore we have a huge shortage of water with no sober realization of what that real shortage is. So I think it's important that somebody embark on this task of establishing a reality. We have development in the desert that's continuing. We have farmers in the valley that have converted to permanent crops that need to be irrigated every year, and all the protections against permanent demand being based on limited supply have been cast aside. So important to the Stewardship Council's effort, I think, is to help meet this challenge by putting the reality in front of everybody. Now, in terms of levees, the critical elements of the levees, in our opinion, rest in that interior zone primarily. We have the earthquake scenario, and maybe we can put that slide up, that the 20 simultaneous earthquake failures in the Western Delta, and the area that would be inundated by that type of an occurrence during a dry year. That is the area of serious concern to the water projects. It's a serious concern to us. We have worked with the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California in terms of an emergency action, which we call the Freshwater Corridor. There's an emergency flood fight plan in the Department of Water Resources to address this. It gets ignored, but in order to protect this area, we need to upgrade these levees so that the earthquake impact would be reduced. The second element is sea level rise. And of course, when we go back to the 1980s with FEMA and emergency hazard mitigation for flood in the Delta, it was planned and agreed to by the state that we would go forward. And there's a small chart, figure four before this one on my slides, that shows the levees that were identified at that time to be the subject of a levee program to bring them up to what we call Bulletin 192-82 standards. Now, currently, the sea level rise issue is being cited, as well as the earthquake issue, as a reason that the Delta levees cannot be saved. And of course, all the planning that's being done here, and good planning, depends on the preservation of the Delta levee system. And the Delta levees can, in our view, be improved to the point that they can reasonably withstand earthquake and also withstand modest sea level rise. The districts that I work for, the reclamation districts, have been embarked on what we call a fat levee approach.
Earthquakes
are... Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you. The next item is at least a 15-minute item. And we have another public comment.
Okay. All right. Well, I would just ask that you look at the handout that I provided to your staff. It will show you the impact of sea level rise. What the problem with sea level rise is, we don't know exactly where it's going to occur and when. So we can only anticipate that, and we've done that by widening our levee crowns and fortifying the base of the levees. And we think that working with Metropolitan Water District and their staff, that we can come forward with a plan that would make some sense for all of us to preserve the Delta. But thank you very much for the opportunity to comment.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Dante, for taking the time to comment, and our staff will take a good hard look at your set of comments. Brandon, the next commenter, please, and then we'll move on to the science needs assessment.
Gil Cozio had raised his hand during the discussion, although I don't see him on here anymore, so he must have dropped off. But I will just mention, Gil, if you want to send anything in, I can make sure we get it to the members. And that's all public comment.
Okay. Well, then we will move on to the report out on the science needs assessment by Dr. Steve Brandt and Dr. Jay Lund. DPIC members, you'll recall at the October meeting, Dr. Brandt and Mike Tchaikovsky shared with us some of the outcomes from the series of workshops during 2020 and their draft. A report on the science needed to be prepared for accelerating change in the Delta. Today they'll talk about where they are in producing the final and offer a recommendation to us. Dr. Brandt and Dr. Lund.
Hey, thanks, Susan. Good afternoon, everyone. Brandon, do you have my slides? Yes, as Susan said, we'd like to just give you a preliminary report on where we are with the science needs assessment, where we plan to go, and perhaps more importantly, to seek your help in us getting there. And the next slide. In the interest of time, can we have the next slide, Brandon? Yeah, in the interest of time, I'm going to go through the background of this very quickly. As most of you may recall, is that this effort was triggered by a memo from the Delta Independent Science Board to DPIC pointing out the need for some perhaps better integrated science programs to address some of the complex challenges that the Delta is facing, particularly with respect to an increasing amount of changes going on and projected changes in the Delta, and that many of these issues actually span individual agency missions, and that this would require scientific leadership, some identification of major scientific priorities, and then to think about the structures of how one can effectively do interagency science. And with that came the recommendation to do a science needs assessment, which was endorsed by DPIC to move ahead with that scientific needs assessment as part of the Delta Science Funding and Governance Initiative. The next slide. I think many of you were part of the activities that we had. Can we get the next slide? There we go. We had four discussions, and these were panel discussions. Some of you served on the panel, as well as a wide variety of participants. We had somewhere between 80 and 100 participants in each of the discussions. In essence, we asked, what do we know about climate change and other changes that are impacting the Delta? What questions does that raise in the eyes of managers? What do they need to know, given that what science needs to be done to address those management questions? And then lastly, are there any changes needed in sort of the governance or funding structure in order to do that integration? We did a two-day workshop to further look into this and to identify those long-term science needs and that span individual agency missions, and then to talk about how we can better integrate the science itself. We had 165 people attend that workshop, and a lot of input on a variety of topics from state, federal, local, NGOs, and academic and consulting and other folks as participants on that. Now we'll get a little bit into the results. The next slide, Brandon. There were some recurrent themes that came out throughout the discussions as well throughout the various breakout sessions we had during the workshop on a variety of different topics. Perhaps from a scientific perspective, kind of the number one sort of over recurrent theme was the need for forecasting, and some would call it prediction, based on stakeholder and management needs, and that is really a high priority for future science and perhaps a framework to structure science integration. And other things that came out of that, which are also could be addressed in part by taking a forecasting framework for doing science, is the need to do synthesis, a need for better understanding of ecosystem processes such as food webs, the need, of course, for integration, the need to balance trade-offs and assess risks, how do we prioritize long-term management goals, and suggestion of increased communication among managers, stakeholders, and scientists, a recognition of the synergistic effects, and that many of the things that we're looking at, either in terms of impacts or driving forces, are really tightly interconnected and interact with each other. There's also a recurrent theme about looking at emerging issues and the possibility of surprises down the road. The next slide. So if we explore this concept, which is really our number one recommendation as far as science goes, is to use forecasting itself as a framework for organizing multi-agency science integration. Now, what is forecasting? Forecasting is something that I think is very easily understood by stakeholders, and because everyone is familiar with the simplest example one could use is a weather forecasting. We all know the value of weather forecasting, and if I forecast or if someone forecasts rainfall for tomorrow, you can make decisions about what you might do tomorrow, and the science related to that forecasting is somewhat subtly and perhaps not so subtly different than the science that's used to explain why it rained yesterday. Clearly, knowing what's going to happen tomorrow in a forecast is far more valuable for management decisions and risk reduction than knowing why something happened in the past. Forecasting is also really the basis for adaptive management. You think about adaptive management, it's by design to assess the consequences of a management decision. Well, consequences of a management decision is really a forecast down the road of if we do this, we would expect the following to occur. That's a forecast. It's the same way with thinking about stakeholder engagement and rationale for science priorities as well. I think it's very easy for stakeholders and users to understand why science is being done in order to develop a tool that will help you know what's going to happen in the future that clearly has immediate kind of application. And it's easy to understand that kind of science, perhaps more so than the science that is trying to explain why this is connected to that. Using forecasting as a framework has a possibility of providing a framework for analyzing or at least expressing uncertainty. If I use the simple example of rainfall again, I think everyone understands when there's a 20% chance of rain tomorrow, or understands the forecast associated with hurricane forecasting, position and timing, tornado forecasting. Those are very simple and operational forecasts, but I think it gets the sense of what the kind of thing we're talking about in general. It's a approach that's been used in the Great Lakes. It's been used in the Chesapeake Bay, and it's actually even being used in California water supply and flood management. It does require science collaboration. It does require multi-agency science integration in order to do this kind of work. The next slide. Forecasting can be applied in a lot of different ways, everything from the physics and hydrology to things like fisheries, human health, invasives, water quality and quantity. Often when you move beyond the strictly physical types of forecasts into the biological in many respects are heavily dependent on the physical, and that by necessity requires that sort of integration of these different kinds of disciplines and approaches. If we go to the next slide. Let's concentrate on the right side of this for a bit. This is sort of how one goes about doing a forecast and developing the science associated with the forecast. Perhaps the most important feature of this is stakeholder and management needs, assessing what those are. Clearly, there's a lot of effort being done in the Delta and elsewhere about how to assess what the management needs are. That ranges from the science action agenda, the science plan itself, a lot of assessment about what the management needs are. Even during the science needs assessment workshop, we came up with a variety of needs, those listed on the left, like harmful algal blooms, water quality and supply challenges, effect on delta communities and human dimensions, fish recruitment and fish habitat quality, invasive species impact and spread. Those are all sort of assessment of the stakeholder and management needs. When you put it into a forecasting, it's a little bit more explicit in that you want to ask the question, what do you want to know? What specifically do you want to know? When do you want to know it? How often? How much time, lead time do you need? And at what spatial scale? That puts it more into more explicitly defining those needs for a management decision. And then in a gray box there, the scientists get together and say, okay, if we put everything we know about this together, what kind of a forecast? How well can we make that forecast? That's the process that also helps define gaps in our understanding, gaps in our monitoring programs, and all of those kind of forecasts are developed by looking at the environmental drivers of what's driving that system, from climate, estuary flows, land use, restoration efforts, or even hazards. When you get a forecast developed, of course, it needs to be driven by monitoring data, as well as using monitoring data to test the accuracy and precision of the forecast, and that leads to developing improvements in models and a loop back to the stakeholders and saying, and management, are you getting what you need to make your decisions, and how can we make this better? In the sense of weather forecasting example, again, a lot of the research, once forecasts are made, are designed to improve the time scale. you're getting forecasts now 2, 3, 5, 10 days in advance. We improve the accuracy in terms of the spatial accuracy of exactly where storms and rainfall events might occur, as well as the parameter scale, I might argue, and that's exactly how much rainfall are we expecting to get, down to the tenths of an inch and so forth. So we go to the next slide. I'm going to give just one example of an application of this, because harmful algal blooms did come out as one of the things that there was a lot of interest in doing that within the Delta. Well, harmful algal blooms forecasting is something that is being done in a lot of different areas. This is one for the for Lake Erie. The photo there is actually a sample of water taken from the surface of Lake Erie right next to the water intake valve for intake machinery for Toledo and Western Lake Erie. Toledo has had some really bad water experiences related to harmful algal blooms. That's Microcystis and Microcystin toxins, the same harmful algal blooms you're concerned about in the Delta. And the way one develops a forecasting system, it starts out with the meteorology, knowing exactly what the everything from atmospheric circulation to rainfall events to spatially explicit rainfall events, that feeds into the hydrology and land use. The water flows, the maps that are developed for this are topographic altitude kinds of maps, soil moisture, variety of things that determine how that rainfall spatially in this very highly resolved spatially explicit way triggers nutrient loads, which then gets into the river system, sometimes with lags of 2 to 3 to 5 days or a week, and then gets into Lake Erie and develops a harmful algal bloom depending on the receiving conditions of the water, biological and physical. And then once you've had this sort of system worked out, you can begin to go back and think about how you might change land use in order to reduce the occurrences of harmful algal blooms. In the next slide. Just don't read the stuff on the right. That is actually the page of the forecast that's being done. NOAA has taken this and put it into a forecasting system for Lake Erie that comes out every couple of days. And that Maumee watershed there is the largest watershed in the Great Lakes. It's over 8,000 square miles, so it's much, much larger than the Delta itself. Resolution on that watershed model is about 1 square kilometer. And that information is used in a lot of ways. The harmful algal blooms are predicted days in advance, and that the water treatment facilities use different treatment facilities, different treatments of the water, from carbon filtration to some biofilters, if they know the microcystins coming down the pipe a few days in advance. Secondly, it also tells folks that where maybe they ought to move their water intake valves to areas that are less likely to receive that that input. On the opposite,
Dr. Brandt, I'm interrupting because we're about 5 minutes from the end of the meeting. I think we're going to have to extend the meeting. Just wondering how much long we do have a public comment.
I have one slide, and then Jay has one slide. Probably 2 minutes left.
Okay.
I'll jump to that next slide. And you could read this, but this, again, argues why and what could be valuable for doing a forecasting approach. And I won't go into this. You can just read this in the interest of time. But it does require that integration of different disciplines. And I think I'll jump to the next slide, and where Jay can make his request. Jay?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Steve. So what we're really proposing here is we'd like your feedback on two items. One, is this general approach of using forecasting a useful method for, acceptable method for trying to bring some more confluence to the fairly dispersed Delta science activities and to help us better prepare as a larger science community for the long-term science needs for the Delta? You can think of the landscape planning tool that was presented earlier sort of as an example of this, but looking forward into the future, how would you systematically update that kind of a tool and the kind of forecasting tools we use elsewhere in the system for this? I guess we're really, one of the major conclusion from the science needs assessment so far is to recommend using forecasting as sort of a unifying concept and framework for helping us all go further, faster together. Because if you don't have a framework for moving forward together, then it's often very hard. The second thing we'd like to ask for is your assistance in completing this science needs assessment by recommending to us several technical experts from your agencies that could help make sure that the recommendations we come up with regarding the implementation of forecasting as a framework for long-term Delta science and linking it to decision-making, making sure that we have people in those conversations that understand what is happening in the agencies and the concerns that the agencies have going into the future. So those are the two requests we have. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Steve and Jay. I'm sorry that we had to compress this item. DPIC members, Jay has put to us a question of whether we consider the focus on interagency forecasting a useful way to go forward and whether you are willing to allow your technical staff to work with the Delta Independent Science Board on refining their final science needs assessment and focusing on the forecasting. Brandon, are there any DPIC members raising their hands?
I do not.
No, I don't see any hands raised. And just to clarify, too, what we will plan to do is I will follow up with DPIC members following this meeting to find out which staff may be available to participate.
Well, then I will take, hearing no objection, since DPIC is not a voting body, and this is a particular request for a very time-bound item, I will take that as an indicator that no DPIC members are opposed to Amanda and our staff knocking on your doors to get the name of your technical staff to work with the Delta Independent Science Board on this effort. Okay, hearing no objections, I think we can move forward on this item. Amanda, we could let the DPIC members know when time frame and of the request, et cetera, in a follow-up email. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I will do that.
Great, thank you. And our public commenter, so DPIC members, if you're willing to stay for another 5 minutes, I understand if you cannot due to other obligations, but we do have at least one public comment. And Brandon, I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, so we have Deirdre Desjardins. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Great.
This is Deirdre Desjardins with California Water Research, and I wanted to thank Stephen Brandt, the chair of the Delta Independent Science Board, for his presentation. And I think this is exactly the kind of integrated scientific response to climate change that's critical. I wanted to let the DPIC members know that both Chair Brandt and former Chair Jay Lund expressed great concern about the future of the Delta Independent Science Board. The state has recently changed the compensation structure, so Delta Independent Science Board members are getting $100 per diem for attending meetings, but there's currently no funding for any scientists to do the actual work of the reviews. $100 a day really isn't enough to fund any real peer review. So I hope that it's such a critical part of DPIC's work and the Delta Stewardship Council's work. I hope that agencies will consider lending both staff and consider providing funding so that the Delta Independent Science Board can do this critical work in the next fiscal year. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for your comments, Deirdre. Brandon, are there any other public comments?
There are no other public comments.
Okay, since we are over time, I'll quickly move to talking about our next DPIC meeting, which will be July 12, 2021. At this time, I'm assuming it will be through MS Teams or Zoom. And Amanda and Brandon and I will work to keep you informed of whether or not it will be virtual. And we'll be in touch with you to get your ideas for the next DPIC meeting agenda. With that, thank you all for participating, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you.